Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you who are new to CSIS, I'm Teresita Schaefer, Director of the South Asia Program here. We have a small, select, but very distinguished group. Let me acknowledge the presence in the audience of Robert Blake, Assistant Secretary of State for South and Central Asian Affairs, Ernest Correa, former Sri Lankan Ambassador to the United States, and former Congressman Jim Moody. We have a very distinguished and interesting speaker this afternoon. Dr. Arvind Virmani has been here for, I think, not terribly long.
Three, four months
as India's Executive Director of the International Monetary Fund. He has served mostly in government and primarily at the Planning Commission and the Finance Ministry in senior economist jobs in both places. But he also spent some time at the think tank that I've always looked on as the most interesting and engaged of India's economic think tanks, the Indian Center for Research on International Economic Relations, ICRIER. He's going to talk to us today basically about India's economy and about what that says about India's role in the international financial scene and ultimately about India's power. So let me, without further ado, turn the floor over to the person you came to hear, and I will move myself out of the way so you can see his slides.
Roughly how long? I'm very happy to be here, but you will notice the green thing there, which is views are personal, and that's actually factually true because it really has very little to do with my work as executive director and before that as chief economic advisor in the government. In fact, much of the research work which underlies some of the things I will say was done when I was a ICRIER, which I was the director for 3.5 years in between. But, of course, I keep adding and varying and so on, and things keep happening. So let me start. I don't know whether I should. Okay, it's easier here. Sorry, is this page down?
I think you hit the space bar.
Oh, space bar, okay. Now, what I'm going to do is give you start with a background because there's a perspective, and it's important because many of you are not familiar with this. This is work I've been doing since 2004, and in a way, the financial crisis seen from this perspective is just one more thing which has happened, and I'll tell you how. Now, the very specific things related to the crisis, I'll just be saying a few things, but if there are questions and on specific things to do with any of these issues, you know, I'd be glad to answer those specific questions. But I think it's important to have the perspective. Now, basically, the perspective which one has been working on is the change in the global order. And the financial crisis, in a way, just kind of accelerates this this process. So we are moving from an old to a new global system. And what I will do very quickly is I will give you the perspective. You know, I first made these projections in 2004-05, and certain new developments happened, and what is the revised? And you'll see how close or how far it is, and that will allow you to judge these projections and what use you can want to make about it in future. But one of the important things which is new, which is a recent perspective, is I've been trying to figure out why there are so many, you know, there are many views of this changing world. And the reason I've determined, in a way, from is the transition is marked by uncertainty. So people have many, many different views of what is going on today. I relate some of this to globalization. The changes, the global system is to globalization is a major driving force. And in a way, the crisis is also a part of that, in a way. So globalization is both driving it and creating these new uncertainties. And then I will focus on one of the impacts of the crisis, which is the last line there, the different impact on export-oriented economies like China versus export-neutral ones like India. Very briefly, the evolution of new global order. I'll just read out what the U.S. NIC national estimates which were made based on Goldman Sachs October 2003. This came out in October 2004, which said that China's GDP in US dollars could be the second largest by 2020. India's GDP could be third largest by 2035. In an ICRIER paper in December 2004, ICRIER is that institution which I mentioned, what I asserted was that the rise of China and India will be much faster than projected by anyone else. Second, that China's GDP at PPP will equal the US by 2015. This is all there in the ICRIER website if you want to check it out. The power potential was an index which I defined and constructed. We can go into that if you like later. I won't waste your time on what it is, but what I indicated that the power potential of China would be 70% of the US by 2035. Potential, remember, this is not actual power. There's two stages. There's basically, the basic thesis behind is that the economy is the foundation of power. And based on that, you could call it economic power. What I call power potential can be seen as a potential for overall power or as economic power in some sense of that word. And that India's GDP at PPP will equal the U.S. beyond 2035. The exact date was not given in that paper. That's why I've just put it in a 35 to 50, because that was the implicit thing. And that the power potential would be 25% of the U.S. by 2035. The basic point here being that we had anticipated that things will move much faster than everybody was saying. I move quickly to the next paper, which was about 6 months later. And Bob may recall this was the period after this or soon after where all the US-India things were happening. And I sent many of these papers to the US ambassador. And in fact, if I remember, one or two papers to the then Secretary of State also, perhaps through you. And what this paper showed was that more clearly than the earlier one, the new thing was the rise of India, that it would be the third largest economy, again in PPP terms. If somebody has a question why I use PPP, we can discuss that, that it will be third largest economy by 2015, that the GDP would equal that of the USA by 2040, and the economic power would be 80% of the US by 2050. Okay, so the implication that it drew from this was that there would be a bipolar world by 2025 and a tripolar one by 2050, the three powers being US, China, and India. And this was further elaborated because the question which always... Have we gone to the wrong one? No, we are still there. Yeah. The question which people asked was, what can disturb this scenario? So some of the weaknesses, etc., which is that last point there, were explored in the book, which is mentioned, and we can go into that. I just want to mention here, it talked about the export investment-led growth model, which is again the thing which will come back, which I will talk about, which has come out so clearly in this financial crisis. And India is governance and public goods, the rule of law. Very briefly again, what are the events? I think they're very important events which happened in 2007 and 2008, which led to some modification, major events. One of them was, of course, the oil and energy price boom and bust. Russia's comeback and the fluctuations and trends in that. I must admit, and I admit these my mistakes very openly, this is the particularly the oil price boom, really I had not foreseen. So to me, that was not in the earlier projections. The second major event was what is called, there was a new PPP estimates, which reduced the GDP of India at one stroke by 36 to 40%, India and China. So in a way, the way my index is constructed, that would be totally disruptive, I mean, in principle, okay? And finally, of course, the global and financial crisis and in its impact on the global economy. So all these three events occurred in 2000 and 2008, and it is instructive and interesting to see what was the effect of these. And then I'll go a little bit more into the financial, which seems to be of greater interest. So what are the medium-term effects? I'll just give an initial point here, two slides on the general effects and particularly the effects on China because and India, which I think, recall in my framework, that those are important. And by the way, after that, I'll show you the graphs, which will then make those earlier things a little more concrete. So there are basically these two important effects. One is the fiscal effect. What is the fiscal effect? Because every time you have a financial crisis, it's extremely costly in terms of government debt. And that's exactly what is happening in the UK and the US. Now, in my view, the impact of that will be to constrain US economic power for a long time, you know, compared to what it would have been. I'm not talking about levels here. I'm talking about the effect of this crisis, okay? So in some sense, the part which is left out, which I have not talked about, remember economic power or power potential and the military stuff, okay, which I don't have data, so I don't have very specific numbers, but again, we can discuss that, where clearly the U.S. is so overwhelming that, you know, you can just assume that adds a huge chunk of overall power to the USA. But that data is very hard to get. Otherwise, I would have constructed. I have an index, but I don't have the data to give the exact numbers. Whatever that military power, even assuming there's no effect on the military power, the actions will be constrained because big power, being a big power or a superpower is costly, and the fiscal constraint is going to constrain U.S. power. The second important thing looking forward, again, from my way of looking at it, you will have slower growth of world GDP and trade. The world GDP is not controversial at all. You know, 99% of economists would say that. But the global GDP, the global economy, will grow at a slower rate. 99% of economists would agree with that. The second part, perhaps, is more controversial. Looking at the historical path, I think the trade, the global trade, will also grow more slowly for a considerable period of time. And those are the implications which I draw below. So if world GDP and trade grow at a much slower rate than they have, let's say, in the last 10 or 20 years, then these are the effects which will follow. One, export-oriented economies will lose relatively. Again, remember, now I'm looking just at the effect of the financial crisis here now. So China's growth development model will be seriously problematic and under question, and I'll say a little bit more in the next slide. Secondly, domestic-oriented economies like India, which have been totally export-neutral, and that I can say that with personal experience, having been involved in the reform since 91, that we deliberately chose a strategy which was export neutral. So we did not promote what we were trying to do is remove the constraints, because we had enormous constraints on the export sector, which we removed gradually in the 91 reforms. Well, some very quickly and some gradually. But we deliberately, and this issue came up many times, and I always personally opposed a strategy which said give special incentive for exports. So there are no deliberate direct incentives for exports. So it's export neutral, what is called. As export neutral as it can be. I mean, obviously, it's again a comparative statement compared to many, many other countries. So India is in that sense much, much less affected than many other countries. Now, that this throwaway line is not really relevant, but in some ways it gives an opportunity for us because of this domestic orientation to speed up, to have another bang of reforms. Politically, it may not happen, but I'm just giving you an economic perspective on this. Politically, it's always very difficult to have these spurts of reform. And finally, as far as the energy or oil-rich countries are concerned, relatively, there will be a return to normal growth. Normal in what sense? In the sense that world GDP and trade for the last 3 or 4 years was booming above its potential. So if you if you think of a neutral thing, if it was higher and it goes below a little, but it'll return to that long-term normal trend is all that I'm saying here. So in some sense, after the shock is over, even Russia will return. That's the implication of that. You know, they will continue to benefit from the energy demand and the demand for other raw materials in that long-term sense, though obviously not in the boom proportions. Okay, very briefly on China, and then I'll put the perspective together as those three changes, what is the impact on the global development, and then further from that. China's one of the things you will see. Can I go backwards also? Can I shift and back and forth? Or once I go back, I can't come back. How do I get back? Huh? The arrow, up arrow?
Why don't you, just
send it? No, just tell me, once you have to show me. This will go forward and back? Okay. No,
yeah?
That's... Huh? No, you are not...
Is this forward?
No, this is back. That was back.
Yeah, and that's forward.
No, but how will I get back? Back this
yeah,
way?
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do you want me to...
No, that's fine. Okay. This is the growth which I just mentioned. If you see this curve, these are the curves of relative size and power potential. The size one is down there, the relative GDP, the pink one, and the power potential is the orange one. So basically, you see them peaking. Now, this peak actually shows the beginning of the decade. It's showing 2010. But my general assertion has been, because you have to have some number there, but what I have been saying publicly is that it will happen by the middle of this decade. By the middle of the decade which has just started, India's growth rate will exceed that of China on a long-term basis, not 1 year. And therefore, you will see the relative gap between China and India starting to decline. But it's going to take a long time to catch up.
So the top, the red one...
Red one is a simple one, so better to look at that. China's economy is currently about 2.3 times that of India.
So these are relative proportions.
That's right. Okay.
So that proportion, that margin of extra...
Yeah, and it's linked directly to growth. This is linked directly to growth. When the growth reverses, the curve will shift. So you get a peak. Up till now, China has been growing. At some point, it'll grow slower than India, so the gap will start to narrow.
It's the first derivative.
Yes, that's right. But the interesting thing is still these current dates are not showing very well. But the interesting thing is it's going to be a long time before catch-up. See that dot there is still 180% or 1.8 times. So it's a very slow process. And that, in my view, has very, very important implications for policy and in U.S. policy towards India. Okay, I'll just complete that. So the implication, which, again, I have detailed papers on this, and we can go into QA, China will have to change its growth model. Why? Because it's had a two-faceted growth model. It started as what I call an FDI export model. That means entrepreneurship, in some sense, came from FDI, whether it was Taiwanese or Hong Kong or U.S. or other countries, and the export. So you have a lot of investment, you export it, and you keep growing. Okay, it's a driver. I mean, this is a simplification. It's not that captures all the details. Till the Asian crisis. And what they found in the Asian crisis, there was a sudden shock, and the economy would have collapsed. So they did a very smart thing, and they've been very smart. That's something you should never forget. They've managed the economy very smartly. They added a public investment component. So there was a sudden spurt in public investment to counter for the decline in export in the Asian crisis. And so after that point, the model has deliberately become what I call an export investment model, but not investment. It's basically public. The word public should be in the back of your mind always when I say export investment. And the second aspect, which, again, is not widely appreciated, because the wordings are different, the definitions are different. You know, there is what we call the public sector in India. Anybody who's worked on India knows that, right? Well, it's basically in China, you'll never hear that word, but it's all driven by public sector savings, actually. This is a huge, you know, in India, we have a rule that all public sector, finance ministry rule, that they must pay at least 20% dividends if they are profitable. There's no such rule in China. I mean, they'll say that some things have changed, but again, it's very difficult to say. But there's 100% reinvestment. Okay, so it's driven by savings investment. It just keeps happening. It's maybe the word, I don't think it's a rude word, but it's like a machine. It's an export investment machine. And that's why they're so successful. There is no country in history which grew at average of 13%, because there was never a machine like that. It was a growth machine. Okay. So PSU investment and much of it goes to manufacturing. So what those arrows show is that change will have to occur. The successful has now become, in my view, a weakness, so the model will have to change if they want to sustain growth. Again, remember, these are all my personal views as an economist. There's nothing to do with any country view or IMF view. And they would be controversial. I mean, if I got three other economists here, they will dispute that. So I'm not trying to present it as gospel, right? This is my view. So It will have to shift from saving to private income and consumption and from manufacturing to services, because that export machine is basically public sector, manufacturing, et cetera, et cetera. And that will no longer work, in my view, because of the things which I said earlier. I think I don't need to say, from physical infrastructure to social, et cetera. India is basically the same thing. The only thing I add here is, because I don't want to go into the details of India's growth, because there's books on that, and I can refer to that, and I can give another talk. But basically what happened because of the 91 reforms is that India was put on a higher growth path. So it has gone, there have been three stages in India's growth, from roughly 3.5 to 5.5 to now 8.5 to 9%. Okay. So what I'm, in fact, here, fortunately, the minister was kind enough to allow me to express these in the economic survey, the last economic survey which I wrote, where I tried to spell it out for the general public, is that to maintain, it's easier to get to a higher growth path, to a higher growth, than to maintain it for decades, because it has to be sustained. If India is going to go from low-income country, which it is today, to even upper middle or higher income, you have to sustain these growth rates for several decades. And the important issue for us is how to sustain this growth rate, and that's where this reform opportunity comes in. Okay, this one I've already shown you. As I said, the important thing here is that how long at these kind of rates. I've been very conservative because, you know, as an Indian, but as an academic, I have to be self-correcting. I have to make sure I don't have an India pro-India bias and a pro- or anti-China bias. So I've been very conservative. I've tried to be conservative in my projections. And in these conservative projections, it takes a long time. Okay. Now, the picture after those three shocks which I mentioned, what is the net result after those three shocks as far as I saw it? These are the two pictures, this one. And the next one will show you in terms of economic size. I think that's the simplest thing to grasp and put your teeth into, but they're just two perspectives, and I want to make basically two points here. One, I think maybe this is kind of a medium-term perspective. Let's see. Yeah, this is 2008 to 28. Yeah, they're both more or less the same. But, yeah, I know what the difference is. You know, because if you... if you stretch it out, you see the higher things more clearly, and then I'm going to show you in detail what is happening down here with all these things at the bottom, because otherwise they are not very clear. So what is the long-term thing here is that you notice that the pink line again is China, and again this is relative to the U.S. So this is the size of the Chinese economy relative to that of the U.S., and 100% means they equal the U.S. So you see here, it will do that in 22. I'll go through all the ones, but it's nice to have the graph because it shows you one important fact here that the Indian economy will break out of this here pretty soon. You see, that is the logic of exponential growth. If you keep growing, the size suddenly shoots up. It's an exponent. What mathematicians understand that, but for general public, it's very hard to understand this. If you maintain a certain growth rate which is higher than another, at some point this always happens. This has to. It's just a mathematical output. Now, of course, remember, I linked it to sustaining growth. Okay, and there's an implicit model which I can talk about if you want to. But here it gives you a little more detail. So let's just talk about China here for a minute. That date there is something like 2020, where the Chinese economy will equal. Now, that is only, we are in 2010. That's just 10 years away. And that is going to have enormous implications for the U.S. And my refrain is that the U.S., I'm afraid, I always question my own breed more, that I don't think U.S. analysts, academics, just appreciate the importance of that occurrence. I mean, what profound implication that's going to have. Maybe there are two or three, four or five analysts in the U.S. total who kind of understand what the implications of that, or even trying to understand.
Excuse me, is this post the recent financial crisis?
This is all the... So remember what I said, I'll repeat it. There are certain projections I made in 2004-05, And there were a lot of things which happened, major events, and this is the result of all those taken account of. So you can judge how good or bad my projections were, at least in this period of 5 years. Okay? So this is post all these things. Okay? This is the current projection. Current meaning I didn't really do it today, but
taken into account
the financial roughly. Because remember, you know, all the small changes just shift these curves a little bit. So it really doesn't. The important thing is the overall picture. I mean, the particular year may change from year to year. You know, if I update every year, sometimes it'll shift a little bit this side, sometimes that side. That's exactly what happens. So it's the picture you must understand, that there will be a point, okay, in this picture, you know, 10 years later, where the Chinese economy will equal that of the U.S., and that is going to have huge implications, which nobody is thinking of, in my view. Again, I could be totally wrong, and I'll stand to be corrected. Okay. Now, this is the more relevant for India, because you get into the details of what is happening here. Here you see orange is India, green is Japan, and pink is Germany. So India's economy in PPP terms is already larger than that of Germany. Sometime in the next 2-3 years, it'll become larger than that of Japan, okay? And then people will not begin to realize till it's like 3-4 years later. It's only from 2015 to 16 that people will start thinking what the implications of that are and the implications of the previous graph in this context, see? And that's been my refrain, if you want to call it, or whatever, okay? And let me just summarize. Just picture is always worth 1,000 words, as they say, but let me tell you the numbers here, okay? What does that mean? We can go back if you want. So impact of the lower GDP. Remember, this is a huge change for an analyst or somebody projecting. It's like a tsunami, 36%, which could have totally destroyed the forecast. Impact of lower GDP, delayed catch-up, partly offset by faster growth. So it turned out that growth was actually faster than I had in my projections, which goes back to the conservative, what I told you. China's GDP equals to U.S. in 2022. This is 7 years later than what I had projected earlier. Okay, so the impact of all those three changes. Economic power, similar delay. Remember that power potential. I have not talked anything about the military and strategic assets. India, third largest economy in 2012. That is 2 years from now. That's also 6 years later than I had projected. And its economic power will be 70% instead of 80% of the U.S. in 2050. So that is the title of this book again, if you can just show it, is From Unipolar to Tripolar World. That is where this is coming from. Okay. Now, the other difference is, just for those who are interested, Russia will overtake Germany by 2015, fifth in size and economic power, because I know there's a lot of interest in Russia here. Reason is oil and gas prices. I agree with those who say that there is a secular trend now in oil and gas. And in that sense, both the U.S. and India, it's very important for us to be energy efficient and these new technologies, etc. That's a huge area of potential cooperation. It's in India's interest to be less dependent on oil. It's in U.S. interest. We have the same interests here. And part of it is what I call the non-market power of energy cartel. It's basically because the prices are not decided in a free market. This is, again, something I have been saying for decades, but the U.S. has not, for various reasons. Again, I'm not here to criticize anybody, but maybe because of the local oil producers, etc., whatever. You know, people have talked about Texas or whatever. I don't want to get into details of that because I really don't know enough. But what I do know is, and which I've observed, that the Middle East or whoever, there's a cartel. I mean, in economic terms, what has always puzzled me is we talk about all kinds of other monopoly. We have a monopoly here. We have a constructed cartel which sets prices, and it's set by states. What other cartel can you have? It's not a market. Okay? So, but we have been unconcerned. The world, the energy users, consumers have been unconcerned. So that's the implication. Okay, let's leave that. And just France, Brazil. I mention again because in some sense, I underjudged or misjudged the rise of Brazil earlier. Again, I have no problem in admitting it, and therefore I've just mentioned it here. I think Brazil will. If you want to see, I can just show you where Brazil is in this. Oops, wrong place. Where are we? Yeah, Brazil is there somewhere, the purple line. That is, it'll catch up with Germany in about 15 years. That's Brazil. So this is much more than I had thought earlier. And same with Russia. You see Russia going above Germany and not exactly catching up with Japan, but getting closer. Okay, we didn't done this, and finally, yeah, okay. So we come to, and this is related to the point about recognition, which I mentioned. Now, we have a US NIC November 2008. That's the latest estimate. And what does it show? It shows that, what does it say? I'm quoting it exactly so that there is no confusion. What it says is the eight largest, these are the best things I could pick out from my perspective to contrast, okay? I'm not trying to be unfair to the NIC. It says the eight largest economy in 2025 will be in descending order, the US, China, India, Japan. So the order is correct. I mean, it's consistent with what my projections are. By 2025, China will have the world's second largest economy and will be a leading military power. I'm not talking anything about military, but again, I think China is still being underestimated. Global multipolar system is emerging with the rise of, et cetera, the development of a globalized economy, which the second part is fine. The first part is what I want to say a little bit more about, which I call the transition. Okay, so, and this is understandable. That's why I gave you those projections where there is a breakout, right? They are still looking at the congestion, so to say. In the next 10 years, this is correct. But there will be a breakout, and if somebody wants to think about what will happen in the future, it may be too late at that point. So certainly India, and I would suggest even the U.S. has to start thinking about it when, of course, they are out of this current crisis. So we are currently in the transition phase, and you see a multiplicity of descriptions. There are many authors, I'm sure all of you are very familiar, pluripolar world, multipolar, apolar, U.S. and the rest, so on. I've in the past used this word, monopoly and the competitive fringe. So you have all these descriptions because right now that's what it looks like. It's a period of confusion. There is a transition going on, and everybody seems to be important, and there's no breakout yet. And I discuss in details. In fact, in the book, I have calculations. I've again tried to apply economics. You see, basically my work has been to try and apply economics to international relations. And what I do is I apply an index. There's something in we use in economics called a Herfindahl concentration index. So I apply that to it and try to see whether there is, and you may be, I mean, that's getting into the details, but I just want to mention. Okay, so it certainly looks like that, but in my view, it's a transition. Things will start becoming very clear from 2020 or so. So what this VIP squared is that index which I mentioned to you, the power potential index. And
why squared?
Squared is the, I hate to use, say the first, but the VIP I chose because those of you who know India, VIP is a very common word in India. And so it fitted well with, it happened to be my name also, Virmani Index of Power Potential. That's what VIP squared is. You know, it's PP, one can write, or P squared. So VIP meaning important countries. In India, VIP is very important persons. It's used all the time. So I meant VIP as important countries, you know, in the global system. Okay, I think I'm running behind my time, so let me speed up. Overall power, yeah, I just want to mention here for those who are interested in the military technology, I have a combined index which uses this VIP squared and a measure of strategic assets which I define. But as I said, I do not have all that data to construct it. And if anybody has, I'd be very happy to work with them to construct that strategic and combine it into an overall one. Okay. And here, just the two important points. The second one, you're familiar, that Russia's importance is partly because of the legacy of strategic assets. So we are really not capturing its real power by just looking at the power potential. And similarly, the emerging countries. You know, China right now may appear to be very relatively weak in military terms compared to the U.S., but it will follow. It will happen, partly because they are very determined to do it, unlike India where our politicians and all have, it's all very fuzzy and it's never clear whether they are interested in power at all or what. But there's no such confusion about in China as far as I can make out. Okay. Where are we? No, I'm going back again. Something happened. Quadripolar. Here, I want to leave it. I'm not going to talk about this because the question always comes EU. So I have addressed that issue in various places, and if somebody's interested, you know, why I'm talking about a tripolar world, okay, rather than quadripolar. Okay, now we are coming to the implication, which I thought was the main thing. You know, as far as I see it, objectives, you know, these are things which are known, but they may explain what I have to say later. You know, from what I know about power, the assertion of power depends, of course, that's been implicit in the relative power and balance, and in institutions and the rules, formal and informal rules that govern them. Again, this is something which comes from institutional theory in economics. Okay, so global powers, when we talk about global powers, we are really talking about countries which can shape the rules of the institutions which govern, either formally or informally, the working of the global system. So the conclusion I draw personally for India is that India must participate in changing the rules, otherwise it's not a power. So if people keep telling me, oh, you are in X, Y, or Z, but you have zero power to participate in changing the rules, then it's all illusion. I put it a little strongly, more strongly than I would in an open forum. Globalization, relative importance. Now, I basically think of power in three dimensions. One is economic, which we've talked a lot about, military, which I just mentioned, what I call strategic assets, which incidentally includes, of course, the defense, but space and nuclear. So again, as far as India is concerned, I'm pretty clear that when we are talking about being a power, though, you have to focus on those strategic assets. Whether our system will or not is a different issue we can discuss. And the social elements. Now, this is what is new. You see the word change there. And in a sense, what has been talked about soft power, in my view, is just part of what I call the social elements of power in the globe today. Just to mention one or two things, what I'm hinting at is democratic. For example, just to take a current example from the U.S., U.S. actions in Iraq or Afghanistan and elsewhere are constrained because it's a democracy. So in some sense, there's a social dimension of power. You have your self-limitation. People will not sustain, for example, Abu Ghraib. A century ago, this would have never been in the news. Nobody would have bothered. But the world is changing. So this is part of the aspect of globalization. People all across the world, because USA is a democracy, it claims to, rightly, I'm not questioning the claim, but I'm just saying that to be an example for others, then others question, okay, that what are you doing? And that will constrain in future also democratic countries. It will not constrain non-democratic countries.
So you're saying democracy promotes survival?
Well, that's a philosophical question. I'll leave for the question and answer because this is my last slide, as I remember. And more specifically, as far as India is concerned, I gave the general thing there. One of the things is UNSC permanent membership with a veto. Again, I'm very clear, and this relates to the institutions. If we talk about India becoming a power, then it has to be a member because that is the institution which is set up globally for power, or new ones will have to be constructed. Secondly, terrorism. You know, it may be surprising to some, but I still remember when I went back to India in the 1980s for a visit, I was shocked to see people with Sten guns on the roads of Delhi. You know, we have been faced with terror for two decades. So this is not a transitory thing. It's something which is right there in India. We've been had to face something which we have been saying for decades, that it emanates in Pakistan. This is not a India-Pakistan thing, but this is something we have seen ourselves in Delhi. So this has to be a major element of India's foreign policy. And finally, technology. You know, in a sense, this kind of brings me to the U.S. because there are parts which I have not talked about, because one of the things which will determine whether there is peaceful evolution of various countries is going to be the balance of power in Asia. And the only way, in my view, because if you remember, Asia in Asia, India will be the weaker power in this tripolar world. And one way in which this imbalance could potentially be corrected is by technology access. We are still denied all kinds of technology under MTSCR, and this has to be one of the objectives of India to correct this. And U.S. can certainly play an important role in this. Finally, the institutions of global governance, and again, this is a joint thing. I think given our respective political systems and constraints, I think the global governance has to move to a democratic principle. And there are some elements of suggestion which I have in various papers. I won't go into it. So I think I've taken too much time. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, there are two different levels. One is a projection and just the general question, which I'll be very happy to answer as an economist. You know, people raise all kinds of issues. Now, in this way of projecting, I have basically an implicit growth model, okay? So all these things eventually go into a judgment about the growth rates. So there is no way, if you ask me what is the exact impact of X, Y, and Z, you know, economic reforms, economic integration, et cetera, I cannot give you an answer, right? That's why I freely admitted how they have changed. That's why I put it up front. And I always say that, you know, well, not always. One of the things I used to say in the beginning is that one thing I know is that every forecast in the world has come wrong. So I am not asserting that this is the forecast. What I'm asserting is this is the pattern which I expect. And it has certain implications. The importance is for planning, not the exact forecast. Okay, that's the first thing. So both these questions from that perspective, I leave. But I can answer, I think, what is behind your broader question. Economic reforms. I have studied growth, you know, history. There have been, I forget the exact number, but there have only been about 7, 8, 10 countries in the world's history which have grown at more than 7% for more than two decades or more, okay? So it's a very rare occurrence. And one of the things I learned is that the important thing is to sustain that growth. And secondly, from the little experience I have of actually studying countries, the important thing is to react to shocks and solve the problems and not let them fester, right? Now, from that perspective, economic reforms, and that is spelled out in the economic survey of last year. The new one will be coming in the next 2-3 days. Don't get confused by that. It's on the website of the Finance Ministry, and anybody interested in details, you can refer them there. There's a chapter 2 which goes into details of how this issue, and in the light of the crisis, because the crisis was also addressed in that chapter. So the importance of economic reforms is not to raise. The raise, I think, is already occurred. We will be back to the high growth path by the year after, that is 2011-12. We have a fiscal year. I have no doubt about that. What is always doubtful is how long you will sustain it. And it's not a matter of 3 years or 5 years. The important, from my perspective, is we must sustain it for at least 2 decades. And that is where the reforms are important, again, from my perspective. So you've got to keep doing things which, of course, if there is a shock and you have to address this, that we did. And it is now recognized by the fund also that our management of the economy to the financials was one of the better ones in the emerging or generally. Okay, so we did. We managed that. And we'll have to do many such shocks. But the key issue of economic reforms is to make sure that you keep doing those things which could become a constraint on growth. Okay, so that's the way I would think of it and would suggest that others think of it. On economic integration in South Asia. In fact, it's very interesting. I've just been discussing with my old Pakistani friends in Washington this issue in the last 3 days or so, 4 days. You know, there is, again, from the growth literature, what it has found is that countries which grow very fast have positive externalities. That is, the surrounding countries benefit from high growth of countries and vice versa. So if you have a stellar performer, for example, in Latin America, just to have a neutral perspective, like Chile, the countries around it have benefited from Chile's high growth. Okay. So and given what everybody agrees, India is likely to be the fastest growing economy, at least the second fastest in the whole of Asia. You know, I would say it'll become the fastest, but that doesn't matter. the fastest growing economy in the whole of Asia for a sustained period. It can have positive externalities on the whole neighborhood. It's not just a question of South Asia, in my view. It can be Middle East also on one side, and it can be Southeast Asia, which has also slowed down dramatically since the Asian crisis. So that is very correct. Now, certainly, these positive externalities cannot propagate if they are barriers. If there is, for example, if there's no infrastructure which links these countries in certain cases, or if they are political barriers, if the country decides that politically that this is not to be done unless X or Y conditions are met, then there's nothing one can do about that. Certainly it's a positive factor which Indian policy has clearly recognized. I remember 4 or 5 years ago, I visited Sri Lanka many times, and the Indo-Sri Lanka agreement, we hold up as an example. I think it gave a boost to the Sri Lankan economy for several years. And certainly that can happen for other countries. But the question is, these countries have to decide that they want to take the benefit of this.
There's actually another story on the Sri Lanka Accord. I happened to be the delegate at the time and was told by the Sri Lankan High Commissioner of the day that it was basically forced down the throats of the two commerce ministries by the two leaders. And so initially the trade agreement had very few categories of trade on it that were actually traded. And it took it a few years to become real, but once it became real, it became quite a success story, right, as you indicated. So there was a bureaucratic as well as a political way. Jim?
Just a brief observation and question. The externalities, certainly there must be, I don't know if you want to try to quantify, the huge negative externalities of the fact that Pakistan and India are not really trading in any full extent, even though they're next door.
Thanks for coming.
That the negative externalities of military potential military conflict, past and future, must be a huge issue if we were ever to quantify that. We could go to smaller than two countries, I would assume. But that was my question. Go ahead.
Right. The negative externality, of course, I'm using in a kind of technical economic sense, but I get the gist of your question. Basically, the negative effects of what is happening in Pakistan, certainly. As far as I know, there is a clear recognition in the Indian government that the Pakistan has got to a stage where, there is a real danger of complete crumbling. And India is willing to work with other countries to see what, including the USA, to see what can be done. But, you know, the question is, what is it that you can do? The elements of the the people who run Pakistan, I forget the word for it, it's a standard word, if they have a different approach to it, anything you do is treated in a negative way, so it doesn't contribute to anything. Talking about the army and the...
crumbling so much as cross-border trade is minimal, isn't it?
But I thought you were referring to the military and other aspects. No, you're talking only about economics?
No, I'm talking about economics. Military aspect has inhibited economics, my point.
Well...
The military...
Right. It's more of a follow-up on the economic integration. But, you know, the whole point is that... That's why I gave the Indo-Sri Lankan agreement. I mean, the countries have to recognize the importance to them. It's not a question of India. India has no problem. There has to be a recognition in those countries. But as far as the relative gains are concerned, of course, there will be studies which try to quantify this. And generally, the conclusions are mutual gain. So that's true. But the point, but I wouldn't put it in a growth perspective. For us, that is more important for the... in a sense, to get change the mindset of treating, if I may be very blunt, the anti-India mindset, that if they see that they can gain from it, that hopefully would go...
Forgive me for going off on that. I want to basically ask a question about the governance. And, to what extent would governance be a factor in these graphs you've displayed to us? I think of China with a very authoritarian governance, not very top-down, rigidly controlled, at least so far, and doesn't show any signs of immediate softening. On the other hand, India, which is a much more democratic, a very democratic system and by world standards, does that impact the curves? If that were to change in China, for example, would that change the curve?
Yeah, in a way, what there's an assumption about a system behind these projections. The Chinese, I believe, that the party, the Chinese Communist Party, will continue to control and run China for at least the next 3 decades. So that is implicit in this projections here. So I do not assume any collapse. There used to be people who used to dream that somehow it'll suddenly change and become democratic and all. No, I don't make any such assumptions.
Then is that curve constrained by the fact you see an authoritarian government continuing, or is it?
Well, that's a very difficult but good question. What we know from history is that what the history of growth would suggest is that the constraint becomes operative at from when you go from what is called a middle income to a high income level. So till they get to the middle income level, which is the next 10, 15 years, that is not really that much of a constraint, given how efficient, and I remember I called it a machine. I mean, implicit in that word is efficiency. I mean, it is when you get to the high income levels when other things become, when freedom of thought and expression may become important for economic growth in a country.
And just quickly, so authoritarian might stimulate the curve for an early phase, and later it might be deterrent. Is that
That's
correct?
Right.
Thanks. My name is Lee Shenzhen. I'm working with the Scholl Chair for International Business here. I had a question. You talked about global governance and it's reshaping institutions, which I think is a big issue for the U.S. As we see, there are three ways to do it, I think, in my opinion. There's reshaping, there is circumventing, which we've seen China doing with direct bilateral aid projects with certain countries, and then the third one would be completely reconstructing a different system. How much patience do you feel a country like India will have with the Bretton Woods countries in waiting for the reforms that bring better representation compared to, say, the Chinese impatience we've seen over the last several years?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Let me put it this way. The context in which I think of this is this, which may help you understand what I'm trying to get at, and then I'll come more directly. The context is, people say, oh, you've been admitted to the G20, you're beginning to be recognized, you were invited to the G8 conference earlier, and therefore you should start doing all kinds of things, right? Well, what I'm trying to say is 2 things here. One is, which I didn't say very clearly, that India is still a low-income country. It's still used to be called a poor country. China is not, Russia is not, Brazil is not, all the other countries we have mentioned, none of the other countries, okay? China is a lower middle-income country. Brazil and Russia are upper middle-income countries, okay? So they are way, way better off than we are in terms of human. I mean, we just talked about power, so we haven't got into that yet, okay? So my response to that is, it's very easy to say, okay, you call yourself a power. No, we don't. We are just saying we are emerging, okay? And therefore, and we have given you this power, now do all kinds of things. Well, what I'm saying is 2 things. One is we are very poor still, and second is that you're not giving power. Power means being able to influence how institutions are governed. And so, again, I'm sorry if I'm very blunt, that it's just, it's just something out there, you're waving your hands. Of course, it's a process. That gets me to your direct question. Will we be patient? Yes, we will be patient. Again, you may not understand. While chief economic advisor, I was there for 2.5 years. And one of the first things I did, actually, it's an interesting story if you have a few minutes. We have 15 minutes according to your original schedule. Yeah. The U.S. editor of The Economist, I think her name was Ann Bedua. She came to see me, okay? And one of the points I made to her, I said, first, you guys were talking about China, okay, when China was doing very well. Then you started talking about, and when all this environment and other issues came up, it was, China and India, and then it was India and China. You please go and see The Economist. The wording changed. It became India and China because you're talking about all these bad things which are happening. We were already up there as most responsible. This is something I told her and I pointed out to her. Okay? So you talk about environmental thing, The Economist and everybody now puts India on top as the leader because you want something done. That is something which I'm afraid is not an acceptable approach. That is not power. We don't have any power. So if it's demonizing, you know, and I think they changed. I think 2 years later I found that it's kind of gone back to China and India. Because you have to be realistic. What are the numbers? Please see the numbers. In fact, I pointed out to her, if you look at the growth, India's growth in energy consumption was 1/6 of the other countries. Let me not be very specific. And still you're putting India on top? What is this? I mean, this is bias. I'm sorry. There's no other thing. So more specific question. Reforms, circumvention, and new institution. We are not in a position right now to circumvent. Let's be very frank about it. That situation may arise 15 years from now. So there's no question of circumvention. Okay? Again, I'm being a little blunt. I mean, you know.
No, it's okay. I'm just thinking in the
future. Right. So what are we going to be doing now? It answers your question. For the next 10, 15 years, we are going to be trying to reform the institution. That's what I'm doing at the IMF. Yeah. It's a direct answer. For the next 10, 15 years, we are going to be trying to reform the institution. But some institutions, if they refuse to reform, I mentioned one of them, the MTCR. Institution is not just IMF. There are many institutions which develop rules which affect us, will affect our growth, will affect our relative position vis-a-vis China and other countries. So if nothing happens on some of those things, then we would have to think of something else. But that's at least a decades framework I'm talking about.
I think it would be very interesting to us if you could give us 2 or 3 examples of the ways in which India would like to see these institutions change, other than a larger presence for India, which we assume is part of what you're trying to accomplish.
Yes and no. You know, as I said, I'm not talking about the government. I'm talking about an academic perspective. The government, of course, you know, any government, if there's a government now, it wants more quota or whatever for itself. Yes, that is the government's objective. But I'm talking about a medium-term perspective for the future. And what I'm saying is that, in a way, okay, let's take rules. If we want a concrete illustration, let's take the IMF itself. You can keep giving quota increases in an ad hoc manner, right? Or you can change the formula, okay? The formula represents a globe or a system which prevailed 50 years ago. So, again, the words, I'm not a diplomat, so I have great difficulty. It'll waste time for me to find the words, but I could probably find the diplomatic words, but let me be undiplomatic.
Please.
If the rule doesn't change, if the formula doesn't change, you are like a beggar. You are not a power. You are every time going for more quota. So the word beggar, as I said, is not diplomatic. But so if power means you have to change the rules, I mean, so that they are not against you. We are saying have fairer rules.
So
we are not saying that the rules should be what we want them to be. But there has to be some logic to it.
So are you suggesting that the formula for, just to pick up your example,
yeah,
the formula for distributing power should be based on purchasing power parity?
That's one of the most important things.
That's right.
There has been an improvement. I'm not saying there's none. They used to have like 10 formulas and mix and all that. But the logic of it is still the same. And so they have now a three variable formula, right? So let me give you an example. In fact, I raised it in the mandate issue today. There is one of the variables in the formula is size of trade, okay? There's a well-known economic fact which has every economist in the world knows from 20 years ago at least, maybe 50 years they didn't know. That is that trade GDP ratio is lower for larger countries. Okay, so you automatically bias from the start towards smaller countries and against larger countries. Is that fair? I don't think so. What is the logic? Why is this fact? And the logic is also very simple. If you think of a thought experiment, there's an actual experiment, EU. You combine 20 countries, the internal trade, the what was external trade becomes internal trade. Okay? So larger countries will always have a lower trade GDP ratio. The trade will be less than things. So the logic and the thing is ancient. It's just not valid anymore. So you have to change it if you're going to look into the future and see this world as it's emerging.
The ratio of what to GDP?
The trade GDP ratio.
Trade.
Yeah. See, if you plot every country in the world, you put it per capita income and trade GDP or size of the country and trade GDP ratio, you'll find a curve like this. Okay, and the explanation for that is very simple. It doesn't require very esoteric economics.
I'd like to do a follow-up on this. My name is Sandrine Rastella for Bloomberg. I know this is off the record, so you can continue being frank. You talk a lot at the IMF in terms of BRICS, with one voice, especially for quotas. How do you see? What do you? Where do you see the limits of this BRICS alliance in the future? Do you see it continuing? Do you see it, opportunistic only for this kind of problems of issues?
Is there a related question or a different question? Let's have both the question.
You want both the questions at the same time?
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Amber Bao. I'm the Scholl Chair also with LEAD. And my question was, you mentioned one of your main assertions was that India would be the fastest growing economy, gradually outpacing China within the next 20 years, 20, 30 years or so. And you also said that resiliency of an economy in terms of being able to withstand economic disaster or also like natural disasters for that matter, like a tsunami, something like that. Yet at the same time, you said that public sector spending in terms of saving dividends in terms of India are very, very...
No, I didn't say anything about public. That was about China. Anyway, I'll clarify.
In China's case, you said it was saving.
Okay. The easier question first, that your clarification. Firstly, I did not say that it will be the fastest growing economy for 20 years. Only assertion I made very specific, which is in the graph, is that India's rate of growth would exceed that of China by the middle of this decade. Okay, that's the only specific thing I've said. Okay? There's no... sorry, just one second. Oh, you want to... I have not said anything else about growth because all these projections depend on relative growth. I don't have to say. It could be 8 and 10. It could be 4 and 6. The basic graph will look the same. Okay? And all I'm talking about is the graph, right? Remember, the broad pattern of the size of economies and linked to that, the power. So I don't need to have a specific growth rate, though I do. I mean, obviously, you have to have some growth rate. But the important thing in all these projections is relative. If you studied internet, which I've done very limited for my papers, I think it's Mir Shaima who says power is always relative. And my whole thing is about power, right? That's one. Secondly, on public sector, the saving... Oh, yes, I see what you're saying. No, I didn't say anything about the size of the... That was purely as an illustration of what people do not understand about China. I was not trying to make any other broader point vis-a-vis India at all. So if you have some question on India, that has to be still addressed. All I was saying is that in China, what they call state sector or village and others, all kinds of names are there, is what in India we would call the public sector. Okay? One. And second, this... conglomerate, problem is there's no Chinese name for it, so I don't know what to call it, has 100% reinvestment of profits. And it's huge. What do I mean by huge? That sector was 100% of the economy in 1980. The party and the government owned everything, right? It's not as it was built up. It was all the assets in China were, in a sense, owned by the Communist Party in 1980 before the liberalization started. So this profit and reinvestment is huge. Okay, that's the only point I was making. People miss that point. That when they talk about savings, it's not only, I mean, this big hullabaloo about private domestic savings, individual savings. It is not that. It is this sector which is doing the savings and investment. Okay? That was the second thing.
And with regard to that, might that lend itself to greater resilience within the Chinese economy than you might be giving them credit for?
Oh, I'm giving a lot of credit. I'm saying that they will continue to grow very fast, as against many people who have said that they'll slow down sharply. Okay, so I'm not giving less credit. But the direct link is a problem. I'll tell you why. That's a good economic question. It's not related to my points I've made. But the economic question is this. Okay, think of the Soviet Union. What happened? Soviet Union collapsed. Why? They collapsed because they kept investing and there was no demand, okay, in very simple terms. The Chinese party has avoided that very brightly. I give a lot of credit to that by realizing that where do you sell? The place which is there is the outside world. So you can go on investing as long as you can sell outside. Okay, that is why the export-led strategy. Okay, what I am asserting now is that is reaching its limit. There's a whole bunch of analysis, and in fact, again, if you're really interested, on the website of CPR, Center for Policy Research in India, there is a talk like this with PowerPoint where there's a graph showing what I mean, why this has come to its limits. But what I'm saying is it's no longer sustainable. Why? Because the effect of the crisis is to create excess capacity in the global manufacturing sector. And if you keep investing in manufacturing, you're going to have more excess capacity. Then you're going to push it out on a world where everywhere there's excess capacity. They won't take it. They can't afford to. Okay? If USA or India has excess capacity in manufacturing and it's got unemployment, they will not be willing to take exports from another country with excess capacity. And that is where the system and the machine comes in. Why do we talk about it? Because the Chinese machine is capable of doing that, as against India or the US. We don't have such a machine which can actually push out all these things, because that's inherent in their whole system and the development strategy. Okay, so that is why it's come to the limit. Now, let's say I'm totally wrong about world GDP and exports merely assume growing at twice the historical 50-year average, then there's no problem. They will continue to grow. So that's your answer.
So you had a question over here about the durability of the alliance among the BRICS. And let me And let me add to that the observation that if your idea of changes in the quota allocation formula were adopted, the big losers would be in Europe.
Well, I'm really not going to get into details of discussion which are going to take place over the year. But as far as the BRICS is concerned, well, the world is in a multipolar transition, right? Right now, if you look at the four economies, as I pointed out earlier, right now we are the weakest in that sense. We have the lowest per capita income. We have a large size. I don't think we even have the largest quotas among them. We probably have the smallest. I don't remember the exact numbers. So we are the outsiders, actually, right? And there was a period in Indo-US relations where, I don't know whether you recall, the former Secretary of State, some people in India resented this, but that doesn't make it less important. She made a statement, or she actually wrote an article or something, I don't remember, it was an interview, where she said that Condoleezza Rice said that it is in the interest of the U.S. To help India become a great power.
She said that in a speech in Delhi.
Yeah, well, she said it. And there's nobody saying that now. So, you know, alliances are the nature of the game. We have... You know, you make alliances to achieve whatever objectives you can. I mean, that's the name of, that's the world, that's international relations. So that's all I can say on that one. More specifically on quotas, et cetera, I really would not like to get into the implications. You're well aware of them. But, you know, what I have been, the issue is this. It's recognized by the Europeans themselves, okay? I mean, you take them into for lunch and they will tell you, right, that they are heavily overrepresented.
Yeah.
So the question is, you know, will the Europeans continue to make the rules of the game and run the global institutions? I mean, that is something for the world governance to, you know, I'm nobody to say for them, but that's what we see, right? So again, in the board meeting today, I made the, what is it? It's a simple point. It's, rights and responsibilities go together. You know, you can't say there's rights we are just giving you on paper and then you have all these responsibilities and vice versa. It goes both ways. So for those who have or want more rights, they have to have the appropriate level of responsibilities. But it's not a candy. It's not it's not that, okay, we are giving you 2% more, so you have to do 2% more than everybody else. It's an absolute thing, right? You have responsibility proportionate to what your rights are. And if they have to, if X or Y has controls the levers of power, then they are the ones who are responsible. I mean, it's just a simple moral principle as far as I can see. I don't think it's anything to do with India or anybody else.